Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMoney.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Centuries of treaties, legal documents all, between First Nations and the Crown set aside land in perpetuity, along with promises to protect and provide for its peoples. But what about the minerals and the oil, gas, and shale just beneath the surface? What about the forests that grew on the land and the rivers that run through them and the fish and the animals that live there and that people eat? Can the government and corporations be trusted to look out for the best interest of Indigenous groups? Or are they better off with one of their own, making sure their rights aren't abrogated, their water despoiled, and their land sequestered? Pipelines, fracking, clear-cutting, export terminals, climate change, is there still time to stop the water, land, and people from being torn apart? A Fractured Land is the name of a new documentary by first-time directors Damian Gillis and Fiona Rayer that premiered at Hot Docs, Toronto's International Documentary Film Festival. It tells the story of a young Native man from northern BC who can throw a hatchet and skin a bear, but is also a lawyer bound to uphold Her Majesty's laws. His name is Caleb Bain from the Fort Nelson and West Moberly First Nations, lawyer, activist, and spokesman. And I'm very pleased to have Caleb here in studio in Toronto to tell us more about the fractured land he calls home. Hi, Caleb.
Thank you, Daniel. It's a very warm and loving introduction. Masi Cho.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
So why did you decide to become a lawyer?
I became a lawyer because after my undergraduate degree in 2007, I went home to learn my language and spend time with my grandmother and just return to my communities. Because I was one of the few people in the community with post-secondary education, I was politely ordered to take a position and deal with the oil and gas industry on behalf of the people. And over the next 2 years, I became deeply disappointed by the state of the relationship between Indigenous people, industry, and government. And I saw massive consequences for the new types of development. And this is the rise in shale gas, the deployment of high-volume slickwater hydraulic fracturing and multi-well drilling on single pads and horizontal drilling technology. So these three kind of developments together create a new land rush in my territory. So in 2 years, I became so disgusted by what I saw. I went out to get better tools to fight. And in my view, a law degree and the ability to speak to judges is a critical tool. And if someone has that from a traditional perspective, with the grounding in the spirit and in the ceremony and in the protocol of our people, that makes their arguments all the more compelling.
And what exactly did you study?
I have a JD from UVic Law, and I was one of the first students granted the concentration in environmental law and sustainability. So my practice in law school, you know, contracts, torts, everything, criminal law, but I focused most of my studies on environmental law and Aboriginal law.
And what do you plan to do with it?
Well,
in three words or less. I'm just kidding.
It's well, no. Honestly, I don't know. The more I've learned about the law, the less I see it as the right mechanism to engage with the types of development that I find most troubling in this country in the short term. Law is good for medium and long-term change. Short-term change, I don't know, and I think that's why you're seeing more direct action, you're seeing more protests, you're seeing more marches in the streets. Short term, I don't know what to do. Long term, I think law has a role to play, and I'll participate in both.
Well, you come from a, I don't want to say unique, but certainly an unusual background from your mother and father who divorced. Can you talk about the conflicting or different influences they brought to you?
Yeah, I mean, my mom and dad, I mean, they were quite aligned at some point to produce me, clearly. And they have very aligned values in some ways. They were both very traditional. They were both respectfully the right-hand person of their fathers, both of which were high-ranking chiefs in Treaty 8, which is how they met. My mother chose, after we left my dad, to work in the oil and gas industry because she was raising two kids on her own. And she rose very quickly and is now one of the most senior Indigenous women in the oil and gas industry in the country. My dad, a residential school survivor, also a very interesting politician, very interesting person in the indigenous world. He turned his back on it all, and to this day remains resolutely opposed to a lot of the development. And that cleavage, if you will, I think when reconciled appropriately, grants people like myself a pretty unique perspective. And in this day and age, we need unique perspectives.
So many people say you can't change things unless you're a part of them. But other people say if you go in and go by the way they frame the issues, you're already on their side.
Yeah. And I mean, the context of oil and gas in this country when it comes to indigenous people, I mean, my mother has made more change for indigenous people in this country in boardrooms than almost any activist I can think of. With that being said, you know, there's a very lively debate in indigenous law, indigenous legal theory, and post-colonial indigenous legal theory in particular about the ability to use the colonizers' tools to dismantle the colonizers' superstructure. My father's position, and I think it's an eloquent one, is that, you know, you have to maintain truly different traditions, perspectives, understandings, values, because those things that stand truly apart, that derive their basis from ancient times, from times before the colonizer, from time immemorial, those are the legitimate basis that founds and creates the foundation for alternative perspectives. And it's only there that you see something of value really come and manifest in the contemporary period. Because you can have, like, you know, recognition, you know, I have the card in my pocket that tells me I'm an Indian, you know, and that gives me certain quote-unquote rights, but it comes with many consequences. My father's position is that, like, okay, you can work inside the system, but, it, you know, then you become an Indian in name. You know, you have a card. When's the last time you hunted? You know, do you still speak your language? Do you still engage in ceremony? And even if you do, are those, you know, simplistic, facile endeavors, or are they, like, deeply grounded in something older and deeper and traditional? And that's a question for all people, not just indigenous people. What grounds you?
With your father going to residential schools, in the film, he says, the bridge is broken. The bridge was broken. So do you think you have all the knowledge and wisdom passed down over generations? Do you still have access to it?
My dad, you know, the three of us testified together at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, one of the big gatherings in Vancouver. What my dad said was, you know, the bridge between generational transfer, the bridge that is generational transfer of knowledge, was burned with me. And I guess to extend the metaphor, I would say that in my view, the bridge can regrow from the land. The bridge can be rebuilt from reconciliation from both sides of the river. You know, as a young indigenous man, I can extend myself back through my traditions and my knowledge and my family and my elders, and he can extend himself from his place and his generation, and we can meet and in that synthesis forge new connections. And I think to extend the metaphor even further, I think that's what has to happen in this country between all populations. And I think more importantly, that's what has to happen between the human species and all the other species and resources on this earth. You know, you cannot be a passive consumer. You have to be an active, accountable participant in this collective endeavor we call life.
So do you think things like hunting and fishing on your own helps you
maintain? You know, the thing is, I mean, anyone can kill. It's easy to kill. And I was trained at a very young age to do so. But to kill properly, to do the ceremony, to walk in a clean and appropriate way, to put your tobacco down in a good way, to kill quickly and minimize the pain, and to process efficiently and respectfully in a way that ensures that that which gives its life to you is not disrespected, and thus that relationship is maintained and nurtured. That's critical. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of people in my generation and younger generations who still have that ability, that training, that background. And that's true of all populations. You know, I'm a big believer that if you eat meat, you should have to experience and engage with that relationship of killing and processing and respectfully understanding, like, what it looks like to see the light in something beautiful in its eyes, fade because of your actions. There's a reason we have canines and forward-facing eyes as a species, but you can't engage in that in a negative or dangerous way without really being accountable to yourself and other beings about in that process. And that's why the hunting and fishing and traditional activities are critical, in my view.
How, if the ports and pipelines and fracking goes through in northern BC, what do you think could happen?
3 to 5 times increase in the existing oil and gas infrastructure, in wells in particular. I would say that that would make northeastern British Columbia a national sacrifice zone, akin to what was done to the Navajos for uranium and coal development in the U.S. The technology to clean up aquifers does not exist as of yet. So the amplification of naturally occurring radioactive materials because of drilling into bedrock that has naturally occurring radioactive materials, the implications of that wastewater hitting an aquifer that has a 10 or 20,000 year recharge rate, I mean, that's huge. So if these developments go through, if the LNG pipelines, if the tar sands get expanded, because they're all connected, right? The shale gas and the condensate that come out of our territory go over to the tar sands. The diluent that is a component of dilbit that goes in the pipelines, that comes from my territory. The natural gas from my territory goes to run the fires in the steam-assisted gravity drainage installations in the tar sands. So it's all connected. And in my view, if this stuff goes ahead, it's wholesale destruction of our land. And because of how we understand land and culture, that means wholesale destruction of the people. And in my view, probably the species.
Do you think this is what automatically would happen, or it's the danger if it happens?
Yeah, I adopt the precautionary principle, and not because, you know, of some ridiculous UN position or because of Rio de Janeiro or because a scientist tells me to. My life, I made enough mistakes to know that I don't always understand the implications of my actions. Regardless of intention, I've had consequences manifest that were far beyond my expectations, despite my best intentions. And I think as individuals and as a collective society, as a species, as a planet, we have to confront that reality and walk in a very careful way. So I would not say it's a foregone conclusion, but if you look at, like, you know, the ambient CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, the amount of plastics in the ocean, or the amount of major rivers dammed, or the, you know, prevalence of increasingly severe storms, or the challenges to our existing infrastructure in such a complex, interrelated modern society, globally and in Canada, you know, we're seeing a situation where, you know, perturbations in the system can cause catastrophic and really unknown consequences. And in my view, we have to be wary of that, because the truth is, as much as humans celebrate themselves and their intelligence, we are oftentimes, you know, hairless, upright monkeys who really don't fully understand the implications of some of the shit we do. So be it. Such is life. I'm a careful man to the extent that I can be, and that's from my own personal experience, from tradition, and also from scientific analysis. What's going to happen may be dangerous.
So you're dealing mainly with the legal aspects of it, but listeners want to know, what can they do? What should they do?
Well, I have in part turned my back on some of the law. I've chosen to become the executive director. I was granted the executive directorship of the Keepers of the Water organization, which is a large Indigenous organization that I am essentially rebuilding. And we would appreciate support. I need scientists. I need artists, and I think I need all people to deeply confront and engage with their own responsibility relative to their consumption of resources, and to be accountable. Simply be accountable. And that requires, you know, educating yourself. And
should people in Toronto be concerned about what's going on in northeastern BC?
Well, because of Line 9, because of Energy East, because we all breathe air, because we all need water. I think absolutely. I think from an ethical perspective, it's also relevant. How we treat the worst of us and the least of us in a society is the only legitimate barometer of how just our society is. And if you go look at how Indigenous people are treated in this country, you will see that this is not a just society. And if you want to be, if you want to be just, you have to account for what's happening up in the Northeast.
Caleb Bain is the subject of a new documentary, A Fractured Land, now playing at Hot Docs. Go to hotdocs.ca for showtimes and to keepersofthewater.ca for more information about Caleb's organization. Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Masicho, and I acknowledge my presence on unceded Anishinaabe territory.
Thank you. This is Daniel Garber at the movies each Friday morning for CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.